Oklahoma bound, tying wire.
I'm sitting across from my good friend Benjamin Alida Sainz.
And I'm sitting across from my good friend Daniel Chacon.
And this is another edition of Words on a Wire.
Here in Studio B.
had to say the Studio B, didn't you?
I had to say the Studio B.
And you know what? It's good to be in Studio B. It's my favorite studio. I don't like Studio A. You know why?
Why?
You can't get internet in Studio A for some reason. The walls are so thick, you can't get internet. But Studio B is our arena, Ben. This is where we belong.
Yes, it is. And our home away from home.
And today we have on our show Nicole J. Georges, who is a graphic memoirist. Do you know what that is?
I do, because I know what graphic novels are, and therefore I take it, it's a memoir using graphics.
Funny thing is, like just like 3 or 4 years ago, a colleague of ours, Jeff Serkin, was teaching a graphic novel class, and one of the students said, I'm taking graphic novel with Jeff, and I thought, why would he be teaching like pornographic novels? That's horrible, because I didn't know what a graphic novel was.
Oh, one of my favorite graphic novels is American-born Chinese.
Oh, who's it by?
Jean Nguyen Yang. And it's wonderful because it really is a story about a little boy and his parents. And it seems very autobiographical. And it's wonderful.
Well, you know, this is the first time with Nicole J. Georges that I've ever even heard of a graphic memoir. And I'm really excited to talk to her because I'm working on a memoir. And so I'd kind of like to see how she gets there.
Yeah, and I'm glad we have her on the show because readers should know that there's very serious literature.
Oh, absolutely.
That's being written as graphic novels. Okay. Mouse, for one, which won an American Book Award and I think a Pulitzer.
This is going to be an exciting show. And then I'll do the poetic license. I'll do a little piece of my own memoir in cahoots with Nicole J. Georges. And you're going to read the poem of the week. What are you going to read?
I'm going to read a poem by Stanley Kunitz. So stay tuned. It's going to be a great show.
Nicole J. Georges is an award-winning writer and illustrator from Portland. Nicole has been publishing the autobiographical comic Invisible Summer since 2000 and has toured the country extensively, including 2-month-long appearances on Michelle T's Sister Spit, Next Generation. Her work has been featured in many publications, including Tin House, Vanity Fair, and Slate.com. Her graphic memoir, which we're going to talk about today, Calling Dr. Laura, was called Engrossing, Lovable, Smart, and Ultimately Poignant by Rachel Maddow, and Disarming and Haunting, Hip and Sweet All at Once by Alison Bechtel, author of Fun Home. In her spare time, Nicole volunteers with senior citizens in North Portland, chronicling their experiences through comics and writing in a zine called Tell It Like It Tis. Nicole J. Georges, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
You know, when I first saw the publicity material for this book, it's called Calling Dr. Laura, a graphic memoir. I had no idea what a graphic memoir was. Or that there even were graphic memoirs. I mean, I've heard of the graphic novel, never read one.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed so fascinating to me that I said to our producer, we need to get this lady on the show. Let me ask you, which may be a naive question for somebody who doesn't know the genre very well, are there a lot of graphic memoirs out there, or are you pretty much doing it?
There are a lot of graphic memoirs out there. The most famous one, which I think your listeners will probably love, is called Mouse by Art Spiegelman. It came out in the 80s, and it is his parents' memoir of being in the Holocaust, but all of the characters are played by mice, and then the Nazis are played by cats. But it's a completely true story based on the interviews that he did with his parents. So there are a lot of graphic memoirs out there. Alison Bechtel's Fun Home came out a couple of years ago to fanfare.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that you can write, you can draw.
Just to clarify things, again, it may sound a little naive, but I want to make sure everyone knows what a graphic novel is, a graphic memoir. How would you describe it? It seems too diminutive to say it's a comic strip.
Well, it's kind of like a long-form comic book. The same way that you know, a novel is a certain number of pages, and that's what makes it a novel compared to a short story.
Right, right.
A graphic novel would be a really long comic book compared to a regular comic book. So a graphic memoir would just be a really, really long comic about somebody's life.
And, you know, this is the first graphic book I've ever read, and I must say I really enjoyed your book. The narrative, the images, I guess you're obviously do the art as well.
I do. Also, thank you so much for saying all that.
Well, no, it's a great book. It's really a lot of fun. It made me laugh a lot, and there was also some very, very painful moments. I have a question about the process of writing a graphic novel. I'm a fiction writer, and I write poetry, but when I write, I often allow the language to lead me, even when the narrative goes in a direction that I'm not, that I haven't planned. And sometimes I'm completely willing to submit myself to the language and see where it takes me, or to submit to an image and see where it takes me. The narrative in this novel, it has a linear quality, but it's also able to go back and forth from adulthood to childhood in ways that aren't linear, that and aren't heavily handed in terms of theme either. How do you write? What's the process? What do you follow? What do you submit to when you're writing a graphic memoir or a graphic narrative of this length?
Well, this was my first long-form linear project I had worked on. Every other comic I've done has been short-form. I guess what I did was I wrote a rough outline of the story. Mm-hmm. You know, it was based on a short story I wrote, a true short story about when I called Dr. Laura that included the psychic. It included the call to Dr. Laura and then my mom's response. And so then I just had to write that in an outline and fill in the holes. And the adult story was very linear to me.
Right,
the adult
right.
story, you know, I was so close to it that it just seemed very factual. I'm like, okay, this is what happened. You know, I met this person. My sister told them they had a secret to tell me. This person, you know, had all these dogs. We fell in love. They convinced me to ask my sister about the secret. But the childhood ones just came to me, and the vignettes just came to me, and so I have all these little notebooks, and I would do something called thumbnailing, which comic artists do, which is where you just do very quick, very simple sketches of everything that you want to draw with the words included.
Mm.
So you're not laboring over elaborate drawings of each thing. You're just getting your mind out, kind of like taking notes or sketching, but you're doing it in a notebook in a graphic way. So I wrote all the little vignettes from my childhood that way, almost as stick people, but I made sure I showed the emotions that I wanted mm-hmm. to have in those parts or the layout. And then I went back and filled in the holes. And we didn't have an order for the book until the very last minute. So the book is composed of a billion vignettes, and we had to go back at the very last minute and decide what order to put them in and, you know, how the reader could best get all the information they needed.
Right. And when you did that, did you ultimately decide to organize them according to a time continuum or a chronology or a theme?
We tried to go with, it was myself, my editor, and then I was working with a production assistant. We decided to go with trying to make it chronological, and then we only had to be careful about where we put the vignettes about my father, because I received different bits of information about him as mm-hmm. we go along.
Right.
And so I just had to be careful that I wasn't putting things ahead of where they needed to be as far as what we knew about him at the time.
Right.
When I was doing some of the vignettes, there were things that I didn't even think fit into the chronology, like the part about me having stomach problems as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But A, I wanted to think of the most embarrassing, vulnerable thing I could possibly write,
right.
something that would make me so uncomfortable, because I just felt like if I was going to do this book, I was going to go whole hog.
Right.
Better just, you know, lay myself bare. And things like that that I drew that made me feel really vulnerable, and I wasn't even sure how they fit into the story. At the end of the day, when we pulled the camera back, we saw that even things I didn't think made a difference still reflected the general mood or tone of that time in my life when I was a kid, and kind of showed through my body what was happening to me emotionally.
Right. And that scene that you're referring to, I think, is the second flashback to childhood in the book. And I think it's fundamental. I mean, it not only allows us to sympathize with her on a visceral level, but it's also embarrassingly funny, the things she has to go through with the dresses and, you know, the clothes and all that. I don't know if I should give away too much of it, but but it seemed like it was very, very well placed. And the other reason why I think it was well placed is because it was not a linear continuation of the first flashback or vignette of the first stepfather. It alerted me that this does not have to be linear, that we're going to just go back into the childhood and just enjoy our time there and then get back to the story eventually.
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad that you liked it.
Yeah, no, it was my first experience with a graphic memoir. You're a zinester. That's what you say in your biography. You're a zinester. What exactly does that mean?
I make zines. So I make self-published magazines, basically. A zine can actually be anything. It could include poetry or art, writing, a combination of those things, photography. The important part is that it's self-published, and usually it's done purely out of passion and rarely making a profit. So I just have a compulsion to write and draw all the time. And I don't want to wait around for someone else to publish every single thing that I write and draw. So I copy them myself or have them copied and sell them to people or give them to my friends. And I've been doing that for about 15 years.
We're talking to Nicole J. Georges, whose new graphic memoir just came out. It's called Calling Dr. Laura. You mentioned poetry in your zine, and I noticed that Eileen Miles is one of the poets who provided a blurb for you, and I think she's just a fantastic poet.
Me too.
Who are your literary influences outside of the graphic memoir or the graphic narrative?
Well, I love Eileen. I mean, hearing her read is otherworldly.
Oh, yeah. She came and read here for our university here at UTEP, and oh, man, she blew me away.
Oh, yeah. Well, now I feel so lucky to have heard her read, because now whenever I read her poetry, I can have her voice in my head and her particular accent. I really like coming-of-age stories and things that are a little traumatic. I really like this author, Lois Ann Yamanaka, who wrote a book called Wild Meat and the Bully Burgers.
Oh, that's a great
title. I like almost everything that she's written. Maybe I like everything that she's written that I've read. I'll take out the almost. I really love an author named Michelle T., who's from San Francisco, who also has been a great help to me in my writing career. She wrote a beautiful memoir called The Chelsea Whistle that I find myself going back to again and again. I love a lot of graphic artists, graphic memoirists. I like Linda Barry, and I like her novel that is not graphic, that's called Cruddy. Mm-hmm. It's very raw. Those are some of my major influences. I really like lady authors that can tap into a dark or semi-traumatic experience around the coming-of-age period and then turn it into art.
Mm.
I wasn't crazy about his last couple of books, but I really went through a Wally Lamb moment.
Oh, yeah. I think I went through a Wally Lamb moment with his first one, I think. And the second one...
I really
love
She's Come Undone.
That was the first one, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
And I listened to This Much I Know Is True on tape.
Uh-huh.
And I really liked it. There was an extraordinary voice actor on there.
Mm.
And of course, I like humorists like David Sedaris.
You know, the reason why I ask about your poetry influences specifically, this graphic novel, there could be some pages where there's only like two or three pieces of dialogue. So the language is very pithy and it's very precise. It seems like that would be a hard thing for a lot of writers to do. I mean, I noticed that most of the bubbles, the dialogue bubbles, don't have incredible amount of dialogue in it, just very, very pithy. So I imagine you must be quite a disciplined writer, and you know what to leave out.
Well, thank you for the compliment. I feel like I have a sense of where I want to show things and where I want to say things, if that makes sense,
mm-hmm.
which is the key to being a comic artist or, you know, a graphic memoirist as opposed to, a writer, is that, you know, there's sometimes where it would be more powerful for me to show a feeling or show a scene visually than to spend time writing it for you.
Right. Like that image of the little girl, you as a little girl, wringing out the dress because she's embarrassed that she urinated in it. It's a very powerful image.
Oh, thanks.
Let me ask you about the revision process. Once you're all done with it, and you mentioned that you have an editor and an assistant that helped you with this. That's kind of interesting. What involvement do they have in the ultimate creative process?
I came to Houghton Mifflin with an almost what I thought was a completely finished book. Uh-huh. The production assistant was someone who was from Portland who had been my intern, and he helped me with scanning and Photoshop cleanup and, you know, all of the digital editing. So just visual things where I had put a smudge mark or I had been lazy and, you know, things like that. He helped me clean them up. And so I came to Houghton Mifflin with a book that was about 200 pages, and I met a brilliant editor named Megan Stacey, who I had long talks with on the phone, unpacking all of these different things from my family history and the emotions behind them. And then, you know, she looked at everything and told me where she, as a reader and as an objective eye, saw holes in the story. Mm. And, you know, I took that to heart and thought about it, and I ended up adding about 50 pages to the book to help readers understand things that I had taken for granted that they might know. And she also helped, you know, if there were places where I could have a stronger phrase as opposed to what I had there.
Right.
She gave me that. So actually, this might curl your hair, but the editing process for me took about a year and a half, because everywhere that I had foolishly inked the whole thing. So everywhere where I had put in a typo by mistake or there was a phrase that needed changing, I had to physically measure it with a ruler, recreate that exact amount of space on a blank piece of paper, rewrite it, scan it in, and then find the unnumbered page that it went with, because we didn't have an order till the last minute, and drop it in. So it took me a very, 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 very long time. I don't think it would take everyone that long, and I don't think it will take me that long again. But
so next time you'll do the images and add the dialogue on a separate sheet?
Next time I think I will do everything in pencil before I even touch an inking pen. And so then if anyone has anything to say about it, yeah. Also, that is a good idea. I think that maybe I will leave the speech bubbles empty and write them on a separate piece of paper.
We've been talking to Nicole J. Georges, whose new book, Calling Dr. Laura, a Graphic Memoir, just came out with Mariner Books. It's an awesome, awesome experience. It's my very first graphic narrative. And thank you, Nicole, for sharing it with us. I just want to mention real quick that you do have a blog called Ask Nicole, and the subtitle is America's Smartest Girl. And it is a very entertaining and insightful and funny, and I hope everyone checks it out and checks out your book. Thank you for joining us with
Words on the Wire. Thank you so much, and welcome to Graphic Literature.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
This week's poem comes to us from Stanley Kunitz. I've read some of his work before here on Words on the Wire. He's a poet I greatly admire. I'd like to read you this one entitled The Layers. I have walked through many lives, some of them my own, and I am not who I was, though some principle of being abides from which I struggle not to stray. When I look behind, as I am compelled to look before I can gather strength to proceed on my journey, I see the milestones dwindling toward the horizon and the slow fires trailing from the abandoned campsites over which scavenger angels wheel on heavy wings. Oh, I have made myself a tribe out of my true affections, and my tribe is scattered. How shall the heart be reconciled to its feast of losses? In a rising wind, the manic dust of my friends, those who fell along the way, yet I turn, exulting somewhat with my will intact to go wherever I need to go, and every stone on the road precious to me in my darkest night, when the moon was covered and I roamed through the wreckage, a nimbus-clouded voice directed me, live in the layers, not in the litter. Though I lack the art to decipher it, no doubt the next chapter in my book of transformations is already written. I am not done with my changes. That was Stanley Kunitz from his poem, The Layers.
I'm going to do the poetic license today. And as you know, poetic license is oftentimes memoir. And since we had Nicole Georges on the show and she was doing a graphic memoir, I thought I would do my own version of the graphic memoir.
The graphics.
Yeah. Or a different kind of graphic, I guess you could say. I've been working on a memoir. I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do with it, but it's a memoir that very honestly talks about my past and a lot about my relationships and, my failures and my successes and my addictions and my loves and all this stuff. But this is an excerpt from it. Well, I think it's kind of self-explanatory. It's about what it was like when I was a Chicano at Fresno State and Andres Montoya and I were activists. And it starts with that, and it just kind of leads all the way up until now, sitting in the studio with across from my good friend Benjamin Alire Sainz. And it's just an excerpt from my autobiography, and I'm not quite sure what I'm going to call it yet. Okay, here it goes. It could happen. She could be the one, I thought, watching her from across the room. She was a photographer and a reporter covering a story on an event my roommate Andres helped organize. She had a professional-looking Nikon with a zoom lens and a press pass and a lanyard around her neck. I think the event was to coldly commemorate the signing of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which in 1848 ceded to the U.S. territories land that belonged to Mexico, including California. That night there were Aztec and fancy dancers, poets, native speakers denouncing the treaty and the continued subjugation of the indigenous. I watched her walk around the large room, taking pictures, interviewing people. She had dark skin and straight black hair. When we ended up standing next to each other watching the Aztec dancers, I could see her eyes were deep green, piercing like the eyes of Christ on a Catholic calendar. Inside of them, I could see the tiny dancers twirling into flowers, spinning blurs of red and turquoise. She sat down on one knee to get a better shot, like a photojournalist, and when she stood up again, she looked at her camera settings and she adjusted them. Then she lifted the camera and took more shots. "What paper are you from?" I asked. "The New York Times?" She shook her head without looking at me. "La Voz de Aztlan," she said, which was Fresno State's Chicano newspaper. "Great paper," I said, "my favorite." I offered my hand and told her my name, and she said, "Duh. What do you mean by that?" Then she turned to me, look at me for what I thought was the first time. "Everyone knows who you are, Danny Chacon." "Really?" I said. "You used to edit La Voz, and when I was a freshman, you ran for student body president." "And what are you now?" I asked. "My last semester," she said. And she got on her knees again to get a shot of the plumed dancers spinning. She looked up at me from down there, making sure I wasn't looking into her blouse, which I was. "You're friends with Andres Montoya, right?" "Yeah," I said as she stood up. "Can you introduce me to him? I want to interview him." "What about me? I mean, you know, everyone knows who I am, according to you." "You don't have a title," she said. "He's a Mecha officer. I guess you could say he's a more legitimate source than you." I think she was flirting because when she said it, she was facing me, chest out, hands on her hips, like she was challenging me. The camera hung heavy around her neck, and I could see in her lens a distorted image of me. "I mean, what have you done in the last 100 years, she asked. "When you were a freshman, I was probably in kindergarten. What are you still doing here anyway?" "I'm writing now," I said. "Writing what?" "Stories. I'm working on a novel." "Cool," she said, like she approved. I leaned into her, looked into her eyes, those piercing emeralds. "Are those eyes really yours?" "Contact," she says, looking down at the camera settings, adjusting a dial. "But the eyes are mine." "I bet your brown eyes look better," I said. "I mean, I like them green. They look great, but I wonder what they look like brown. I bet they look like a Diego Rivera." I think she blushed. I took her over to meet Andres, and he was all smiles, ready to flirt with her. But I whispered into her ear, "Talk to me before you leave. I have an exclusive for you." She turned her torso and looked at me. "Really?" she said. I left them alone. A little later, I was talking to a friend of mine, Willie Shoshone, president of the Native American Club, which among ourselves we called the Indian Club. She approached with her notepad and asked Willie if he could say something about the importance of the event. And Willie offered the narrative of the broken treaties, the tradition of oppression. She wrote it down, nodding, and then she said, "Thanks," and turned to me and said, "Well?" "Yes, the exclusive," I said. I nodded, "See you," to Willie, and walked with her to the exit. "I don't think we should talk here," I said. "Too many eyes and ears. Maybe we can meet somewhere tomorrow. Coffee or a drink? Yeah, you think, she said. We walked out together and I followed her to her car, a white Toyota Corolla. We talked for a while, leaning against her car. She lived in a rural town outside of Fresno, about an hour's drive, with a population of less than 3,000 people, 98% of them Mexican, the kind of town that doubled in size during the picking season. Her father was a foreman on a farm, but he had been a farm worker since she was born. She was graduating in the fall, and then she wanted to go to law school. I told her I was writing fiction, that I had got my degree in political science with the intent of going to law school, but now I realized I had no desire to practice law. I wanted to be a writer, a decision I never gave up on, would never come to regret. So can I call you? I asked. She wrote her phone number on the black business card, and because it wasn't her card, she X'd in ink the information on the front, some accounting firm. I watched her drive her Toyota out of the lot and through the narrow campus streets, and I saw her taillights waiting at a red light to cross Shaw Avenue. The next night, my friends and I were drinking beers, and I had a buzz which gave me courage. So I went to my bedroom, closed the door, and called her. An older lady answered in Spanish, and I spoke the few words that I knew. ¿Está Lisa? She said something I didn't understand, but a moment later I heard her voice. This is Lisa. She sounded so confident. What are you doing home on a Saturday night? I said. No friends, no parties. Danny Chacon, she said. Don't you know about the 3-day rule? I hope you're not desperate. That caught me off guard, and I liked it. We joked around for the next 30 minutes. Until Andres knocked on my door and yelled, Sparky!
Thank you, Daniel. You know, it's really interesting how you can take an encounter and really make it just an encounter and turn it into a piece of literature. And I really appreciate that.
Well, you know, it reminds me of Nicole George's taking aspects of her life and turning it into this wonderful graphic comic, you know, and it's kind of, I don't know, it's different, but it's the same. It's all autobiography.
Yes, and it's a difficult thing to do, actually. And one of the great things about a piece like you just read is, in fact, how we always go back to memory, and it's amazing how many things we remember.
Right, absolutely. And I think you need to write your autobiography. It would be the most amazing story. You know, all the stuff you've been through.
Thank you, Daniel, for that.
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Benjamin Alida Sines.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of Words on a Wire. Make sure you join us again next Sunday at 11:30 a.m. And don't forget,
the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see. And the wire seems to be the only place for me. A comedy of errors and I'm falling. Like a rubberneck giraffe, you look into my past. Well, maybe you're just too blind to see. I'm up in the spotlight. Oh, does it feel right? Well, the altitude seems to get to me. I'm up on a tight wire.